The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
There was a time when eating was pleasurable. Now it bores me. Just fuel for survival. I can't afford the luxury of anger. Anger can make me vulnerable. It can destroy my reason, and reason's the only advantage I have over them.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, June the 19th, 2024. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's Just Right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
If there's one word that most people do not associate with politics, it's the word reason. And you know, there could be a reason for that. A lot has happened over the past week that continues to bear upon our theme introduced last week about how the political right wing is flying in every direction, making it difficult, if not impossible, to defeat the left. This week's show essentially continues along that theme, which resumes right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org, hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. One of the problems concerning the use of the terms left and right is that to most people, these labels are not attached to ideas, but simply represent a form of opposition. A right-winger is a person who's against what he perceives as the left-wingers, and the left-wingers regard a right-winger as anyone who does not support their ideology. The major problem with the right-wing is that it always acts in opposition. It fights against the values it says it doesn't support, but does not fight for or define the values that it's supposed to represent. As Isabel Patterson always warned, when we speak of government, force is what is governed. And this is so key. Both left and right are competing polarities with regard to the legal use of physical force. The left requires the use of initiatory force for whatever it wants to do, from providing social benefits to locking up political prisoners. The right, the ideologically true right, restricts itself to the use of defensive and retaliatory force in the protection of life, liberty, and property. Now, this past week, I was made aware of an American libertarian previously unknown to me named Dave Smith. And after hearing him speak to Tucker Carlson for about 2 hours, I would classify Dave Smith as being on the right. While many who call themselves libertarian, I would classify as being on the left. In fact, not only libertarians, but also conservatives and objectivists have their right and left adherents. A dilemma that we'll be discussing as our show progresses, beginning with the following May 16 conversation between libertarian Dave Smith and former libertarian Tucker Carlson. Bear in mind that this conversation took place before the Libertarian Convention.
I mean, it's a little weird for me because you're a libertarian. And in fact, you could even wind up on a libertarian ticket at some point, if not this cycle. No, but I'm just saying it could happen, right? So you're literally a libertarian. But for some reason, we have the same instincts on almost everything, I would say. There are a lot of people in conservative media who I always have felt like I had a lot in common with, and now I don't. And it's not because I've gotten liberal. I've gotten way less liberal. Right. I see them as way more liberal. So what happened to conservative media? Not all of them. I have a million friends in it, but like a lot of the big names seem very liberal to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's kind of the same thing that happened to libertarians. I think they're in Washington, D.C., and that's not where you're supposed to be.
No, that's right.
And so the best libertarian organization in the world is the Mises Institute, and it's based in Auburn. And they
Alabama.
Yeah. And they specifically put it there because they like want no part of Washington, D.C. And then you see all of the you know, Cato and guys like that who are based out of DC, they get very corrupted. And they, and you can look at it. It's like, it's the same thing. We were just talking about Donahue calling out Chris Matthews back in the day. Yeah. They're having cocktail parties with the Fed chairman. Wait, you're a libertarian. You shouldn't be doing that.
They're actually doing that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Actually doing that. And I think a lot of that's the same problem with the kind of conservatism ink or whatever. Yes. They've been corrupted. And power is seductive. And I'm sure you know that from like being in DC for so many years that you, I'm not saying like you're kind of an anomaly. Think about all the people in Washington, D.C. and how much all of them wanted to suck up to power almost, right? Like what, 90-something percent?
At least. That's why they're there.
Right. And so it's a difficult thing to...
I didn't get that for some reason for so long. I was living in the middle of it. I don't know. I'm not a super genius. So I didn't realize how corrupt it was. Everyone always said it was corrupt. It felt like a really nice place right. to me. I raised all my kids there. But when you realize how corrupt it is, I mean, it's horrifying.
Yeah. But that's also, I think there's something like the nature of conservatism or the conservative movement in America has always just been to lose. Like they're, it's like built into them. Like every generation just loses and then moves on to the next thing to lose. I like the old right, the you know, Robert Taft,
right.
They were largely in opposition to the New Deal. That was, they were fighting back against the yes. FDR's New Deal. We're in opposition to that. And then, you know, you cut forward 20 years and it's FDR Democrats are the new Republicans, right? Ronald Reagan exactly. is like, it's nobody would dare question the New Deal. And then of course there was a movement pushing back against the Great Society and
yes. 60s.
And now of course, no entitlements are like, no one would ever dare question Medicare. And look, just recently I saw Donald Trump, who's not a traditional conservative, but he did the most traditional conservative thing when he said, when we get in there again, we are gonna fix Obamacare. And I'm like, oh, okay, right. So that's where we're at now, right? It's a no more repeal and you don't even hear Republicans talk about it anymore, right? So it's always like the next round of big government increases, the next round of centralized power in DC, they will put up a little fight, they will lose, they will then a few years later accept this as something that is consensus amongst all of us. But you see, we're against whatever the next thing is, you know, transing the kids or, you know, student loan bailouts. We're against that now, you know, but they'll lose and then eventually accept
but
that.
Why would you, so that, what does that suggest about them? They don't, this is a performance. This is not sincere.
Yeah. I mean, conservatives typically have played the role of being against consolidating power in DC.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's, obviously, that's going against the wind, not with it. And so it's almost like it almost seems like a professional wrestling thing where they're like, they're the ones who are supposed to lose at the end of the day. They kind of say the right thing, never really mean it, you know, and then ultimately acquiesce.
I have to say, I was disgusted by the lack of fight in a lot of professional conservatives during COVID, mm-hmm. like disgusted by yeah. it. You know, banning freedom of movement, freedom of speech, bodily autonomy. Like the whole thing was like so mind-blowing to me. And if this actually was the totalitarianism we've been worried about or pretending we're worried about for a long time, it came. And a lot of them didn't say anything about it. But I was totally bewildered by the libertarian response, which was also kind of silent. I thought Cato would be, I don't know, camped out in front of the White House or the CDC or like what was that?
Well, it shows you. I mean, it's well, just and because you use the word totalitarian. And I think sometimes when you use that word, it's perceived as like being somewhat hyperbolic. But it's really like what else could describe lockdowns?
Well, that's what I mean, thought.
That is totalitarianism. You had American citizens turning on their TV every morning to find out from their governor what they were allowed to do.
Well,
today.
Exactly.
Like, I mean, the most you couldn't imagine, like if the question was like, can I have a funeral for my dad? And they're like, sorry, no, we've decided you can't. You know, I mean, like the most intimate details.
Yes.
Liberties that we would all have taken for granted. And so, OK, to your point. Right. Not only did conservatives not fight against it, I think the majority of them cheered it on or went along with it.
Yeah, I noticed.
And as far as the, you know, the point about libertarians, there are kind of like, there are these moments And I know you experienced this a lot when you were on your Fox show. There are these moments where there's like a storm, where there's something's like a white hot issue, you know?
Yes.
And it becomes very easy later after that passes to be on the right side. And so a lot of just what, back to your original point about like the libertarians who failed on the job, a lot of it is simply comes down to be a matter of courage. It's just a matter of like, hey, when the issue that might make everyone hate you, exactly, and all of the powerful people call you the worst names, which naturally human beings have a tendency to not want that. We don't want to be ostracized. You don't want to be called these names.
Right.
Some people just kind of have this personality trait. And this isn't like whether you're on the left or right. It's something that you have. It's something I have. It's something Alex Berenson has.
Yes.
He's kind of like, I don't care.
But it's so like perfectly and like with great discipline executed. It's like in a space of 4 hours, the entire machine turns on one guy and destroys him. Like, how, what is that? You can see why people come up with conspiracies to explain that, right?
Sure. Yeah. And they are quite possibly right. I mean, I don't know exactly what the conspiracy is, but it quite possibly is one.
But no dissent at all.
Yeah. But then my thing is just that I do think, and I think this is something I've benefited from. I know this because I hear this back from my audience a lot, that it's like, oh, when you were right on those issues, when it really mattered, you kind of gain credibility.
Well, that's right.
And I also think that, like, you know, let's say there's like, I don't know, like a right wing or conservative commentator who's telling you how you have to feel about the new storm right now. Mm. It's like, well, just tell me, how did you do on the last three storms? You know, like were you telling dopes to get the vaccine? Were you telling everyone to be socially distanced? Or were you like on the right side of that? Where were you on Ukraine? You know, were you saying that like, oh, you know, like they can win or whatever the story is? You know what I mean? Like it's, and I do watch a lot of people who go like, got everything consistently wrong. It's the same way as the neoconservatives, right? Like even if, I mean, I hate them so much. It's hard to speak about them like with any type of sense of fairness. But how do you, listen, let's just say you got six wars wrong and you were wrong about every single one. Like, let's just say you were for the war in Iraq and then you were for, you know, regime change in Afghanistan against the Taliban, who did not attack us. And then you were for overthrowing Gaddafi, and then you were for overthrowing Assad, and then you were for backing the Saudi war in Yemen, and like all these things, and it's just nothing but disaster. Every one of them. Okay. But then you're going to come out and confidently be like, and I'm for this next war. And let me tell you why you have to be too. And you don't have like enough just... like you don't feel humiliated enough that like you couldn't come out. Even if you were for this, you'd be like, man, I really think we should fight this war, but I can't come out and say we should fight this war because the last six times I said it, it was nothing but a disaster. But the same people who were like, you see, Tucker, when we overthrow Saddam Hussein, democracy will sweep the region. And you see, we're going to be greeted as liberators. We won't be fighting off a 20-year insurgency, you see. They'll greet us as liberators because they love us. And then democracy will sweep the region. And then Iran will lose influence in the region. And then Hezbollah will start being nice to Israel, and like all these grand predictions, and every last one of them, oh, it'll be paid for in oil. Do you remember all the things they used to say?
Very well.
I mean, it's you know, it's a cakewalk. It's a slam dunk that he has weapons of mass destruction. So every single one of these things you were wrong about, you get to now be the person advocating the next one.
But you wouldn't ever allow that kind of behavior in your children.
Of course.
You can't let a lie stand. Kids lie, you catch them lying. And the whole point of the exercise is to get them to admit to your face, yes, I did this. No, I won't do it again.
Right.
Like that's an integral step, right? You have to go through that or else you don't improve as a person. You become shittier as a person.
Yeah, that's right. And I would also, maybe this is me adding my libertarian bent to this, but I would also say that in the private sector, and I mean not like the crony connected to government private
right.
sector, but like in true business, you also don't get away with that stuff.
Well, of course
you
not.
Can't just fail over and over again
right.
and then
no,
move up. This only happens either in the government or in, you know, companies that are essentially the government, but you know, like live off no bid government contracts
right.
or something like that. But yeah, it's and it's the major problem is that look, like, at least there are problems with free markets, and they're, it's made up of human beings, so there's always problems, but there's at least like a cleansing mechanism. Yes. There's like profit and loss.
Yes.
If you lose too much, you go out of business. In with government, the worse you do, the more funding you get.
But so this is,
if the kids can't read, we need a higher education budget.
I completely, you know, agree with you. And for all I piss on libertarians, and of course I was one for most of my life.
I'm going to bring you back. Give me time.
Well, no, it's just interesting. I think the reason I'm mad at libertarians is because I don't see a free market in the United States.
Oh, of course not. Yeah.
Right. And yeah. So, I mean, I look at green energy or the defense space, and like there's that bears no resemblance to a market at all.
Well, and a lot of
finance.
Yes. But I would also point out that, like, look, there are, just like with every group, just like conservatives, there are different camps within libertarians.
Yes.
So just to point out, like the thing I said about the last five storms, if you go listen to what Ron Paul was saying throughout the entire COVID regime.
I love Ron Paul.
He was perfect. Yes. Tom Woods, Lou Rockwell, Jeff Deist. Like there's this group of libertarians who were great the entire time.
Well, I totally agree. I've never stopped loving Ron Paul.
So the difference between, say, like the Ron Paulian libertarians, which I would consider myself to be one of, and say like the Cato or groups like that, is that the Cato types tend to like almost have this academic discussion of what it would be like in a free market and then talk as if that's what we're living in right now.
But that, you know, I mean, I was a fellow at Cato, so I remember this very well. That organization, that foundation, 501c3, is run by an oligarch,
mm-hmm.
actually.
Yeah.
It's run by Charles Koch.
That's right.
So he kicked out the old head, he brought in the new head. And you sort of wonder if you're a libertarian, you're not for government power, but you're also suspicious of oligarchs, right? Aren't you?
Well, of course. And particularly, like, say, the same oligarch who's not only funding the Cato Institute, but is also funding the Republican Party in general.
Well, exactly.
And the party who consistently is growing the size of government every bit as much as the Democrats are. I mean,
well,
it's almost like, you know, it's become a thing where if a Republican were to ever say, you know, say we need smaller government, or like Nikki Haley was talking about smaller government, you just roll your eye because it never means anything.
Yeah, like more freedom through less government. These are known as floating abstractions. The problem with individual libertarians and conservatives is that you can never be sure whether they're on the left or right until you hear their specific views expressed applied against certain key principles, particularly the distinction I highlighted earlier regarding the use of force. For a movement that always talks about the initiation of force, the libertarians rarely talk about the flip side of the force issue, defensive and retaliatory force. And why is that? Well, I'm guessing that it's because these forms of force require a government, which so many libertarians already regard as unacceptable on the face of it. Now, last week we featured Mark Dice's reaction to Trump's attendance at the Libertarian Convention in D.C. This time round, it's David Freiheit of Viva Fry who takes aim at the same event.
And I'm catching up on some news, rereading some tweets from yesterday, and it seems that the libertarians are doing their very, very best to confirm all the worst stereotypes of libertarians. But the capital L libertarians just had their libertarian convention in DC, and two of the notable speakers were Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Donald Trump. And my goodness, some videos have gone viral by lefties and libertarians alike of the crowd booing Donald Trump. Well, they gave the leftist MSM Trump derangement syndrome media the video clips that they have wanted for the longest time so that they can run with it. But my goodness, if you haven't seen what actually happened, here's what actually happened. And my goodness, I'll show you the punchline of Donald Trump's response in a second.
But he's a great libertarian, D. Roy Murdoch, who I've become friends with through his writings in the American Spectator and numerous other places, wrote an article yesterday in which he mentions just some of the things that make me a libertarian without even trying to be one. That's nice. Donald J. Trump will address the Libertarian Party at its national convention on Saturday. The Libertarian Party should nominate Trump for president of the United States. Only if you want to win. Only if you want to win. Maybe you don't want to win. Maybe you don't want to win. Thank you, D-Roy.
But you got a bunch of people booing, as is their right to do if they want to behave like a bunch of children and confirm all the worst stereotypes of libertarians. And just wait until you hear Trump's zinger of a response. It's hilarious. Perfect response to the crowd who is sitting there booing him at an event, at a convention where he had the courage to get up in front of a crowd who could have been hostile in the political sense. He gets up in front of them, tries to convince them of his position, and he gets booed like they are a bunch of rabid lefties. But Donald Trump, true to form and in impeccable timing, replies as follows.
Thank you, D-Roy. Thank you. No, only do that if you want to win. If you want to lose, don't do that. Keep getting your 3% every 4 years.
Now, in fairness to the Libertarian Party, it is not a unified party. There's no litmus test in order to be a member of the Libertarian Party. In a way, it's kind of like the People's Party of Canada. There's no litmus test. There's no political ideology that all of the members must adhere to. Some can be pro-choice. Others can be pro-life. Some can be pro-firearms restrictions. Others can be pro-gun rights. So there's no litmus test. And so you're going to get a bunch of varying people, a bunch of different ideologies within the group. There will be no uniformity of thought, which is a good thing. But there should be at least some decorum of behavior. Now, I got into a little bit of trouble or back and forth with some libertarians on Twitter because I said, this is typical leftist behavior. You boo down, you shout over your invited speaker or your guest speaker, and you think it makes you right? No, it makes you a bunch of lefty idiots. And for greater clarity, I don't mean lefty in the political sense whatsoever. I just mean it, yes, as a critique of childish juvenile behavior, employing tactics that the left employs to shut down and stifle speech instead of listening with an open mind and then having a discussion afterwards. Okay, all right, that being said, libertarians acting like a bunch of children, so much so that even Dave Smith had to give them something of a warning. And before we even get into Dave Smith's video, there's some humor here because another libertarian account on Twitter posted a video criticizing Dave Smith saying, look at Dave Smith, he's groveling, begging for libertarians to vote for Donald Trump. And the person posted a video clip that seems to have been untimely cut short and didn't include everything Dave Smith said of relevance. Chris Spangle, at Chris Spangle Follows Me, host of The Chris Spangle Show and History Mod Pod, at WER Libertarians, this is what Chris had to say, at Chris Spangle. Be ungovernable as long as you're nice and respectful to the president. At Comic Dave Smith, this is so f***ing embarrassing for you. I've said it before and I'll say it again. When someone resorts to shaming with no substantive critique, that is a typical leftist tactic. Shame on you. How dare you? This is so embarrassing for you. Do better. Unless you have some substantive critique to it, that is just typical leftist tactic. And Dave Smith had a little something to say about it, and I'll say this. This is the most epic ratio I have seen in recent memory. Hey, Chris, two questions for you. Did you miss the rest of this, or are you intentionally cutting it out? Also, remember when we debated and I f***ing humiliated you easily? Happy to do it again anytime, but we both know you don't want that, coward bitch. All right, so now we're going to watch what Dave Smith had to say. I'm going to cut the video at the point where it was originally cut off in Chris Spangle's tweet, and I'm going to play the full 3 minutes with that delineation in there so you can see what was said before and what was cut out from Chris Spangle's tweet. But still, Dave Smith has to get up there and say, look, everybody in the crowd, we are not a bunch of university lefties. This is not what we do. We don't boo down people because we don't like what they have to say. We listen to them and we dialogue, and I like Dave Smith. The crowd would have been good to listen to his advice.
Okay, listen. There's broadly speaking, I think, two groups of people here. Okay? No, but I'm serious. There are members of the Libertarian Party, and there are people who came here to support Donald Trump. Listen. I have a message for both of you individually. I hear you. To the members of the Libertarian Party, which I am also one. Guys, listen, here's my message to the libertarians here. The former president of the United States of America and the current frontrunner to be the next president is here to talk to you. We are not a bunch of college leftist sissies. We believe in free speech. So be respectful. I'm not telling you you have to agree with him, and I'm not telling you you have to cheer for him, but we're not having a, like, Jordan Peterson at Berkeley event here, and the message we're sending to the world is not that we can't handle ideas that we disagree with. We are libertarians. We are constantly surrounded by ideas that we disagree with. We're in Washington, D.C., for God's sake. And here's my message to the Donald Trump supporters who are here. You came to the Libertarian Party National Convention, and we're libertarians around these parts. So let me tell you a little bit about what we believe in case you're not sure. Here's what we believe. Donald Trump, as president of the United States of America, was framed for treason by his own deep state.
So those are the words of wisdom from Dave Smith, and they appear to be words of wisdom that the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire does not want to listen to or is incapable of listening to, because this is what the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire, at LPNH, put out on Twitter. I cannot believe the terrible, malicious judgment of this party. It seems like a genuine bona fide troll account, and if it is, libertarians across America should disavow them. Libertarian Party New Hampshire, at LPNH. Based in respect of what? One Libertarian Party member shouted, quote, Donald Trump should have taken a bullet, end quote. And coming back to the theme that libertarians behave like rabid lefty lunatics, I had to reply to that tweet as follows. So you think that disagreeing, even vehemently, with his policy and decisions is a justification to support promote a tweet message wishing that Trump had, quote, taken a bullet, end quote, as, quote, based, end quote? You know who else adheres to this political philosophy slash tactic? Hint, they are currently trying to lock Trump up. You're not in good company at LPNH. There's an old joke that 95% of lawyers give the other 5% a bad reputation, except it's not really a joke, it's a statistical truth. Well, the Libertarian Party is doing a good job at giving all libertarians a very, very bad reputation and showing why they are not a serious party to be taken seriously, but rather a grouping of a bunch of juvenile kids. And I say that as someone with strong libertarian leanings. I studied philosophy. I studied John Stuart Mill. I think that the government is the necessary evil that needs to be kept as small as humanly possible. But my goodness, this type of behavior, it just makes the Libertarian Party the laughingstock that they have become, and they should really reassess what they're doing in the political sphere. That being said, full credit to Donald Trump for attempting to talk to this crowd. And there was another tweet that I don't want to misrepresent. I'll read it right now. Libertarian Party of Florida, at LP underscore Florida. Ha 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 ha. At real Donald Trump looks mystified that a room full of passionate libertarians booed him when he asked for our votes and endorsement. Laughy face emoji, laughy face emoji, laughy face emoji, laughy face emoji. What an amazing convention. To which I responded, don't confuse, quote, mystified, end quote, with, quote, disappointed, end quote. And if you look at Trump's face here, I can see no other sentiment other than true, sincere disappointment. So that's that. You don't win an argument just because you boo louder than the person speaking. You don't win an argument because you shout down the speaker, although I will still say that the cheers were exponentially and remarkably louder than the boos, but the media will not run with that. They're going to run with the boos because that's the narrative the leftist media wants to convey, and congratulations, libertarians, you gave them the fodder they needed.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. On the same day as our show last week went to air, I received my monthly mailer from Harry Binswanger, a well-known objectivist who happened to be the editor of the Ayn Rand Lexicon, from which I often borrow quotes of Ayn Rand on this show. Turns out he's a globalist, very unlike Ayn Rand or her intellectual heir, Leonard Peikoff, but very much like Yaron Brook of the Ayn Rand Institute, who has been a guest on this show, as well as having delivered an address to the Freedom Party of Ontario in the past. So even among those calling themselves objectivists, there is no consensus on very key and fundamental issues. There's still a left and right political polarity within that movement, which is why you might hear some objectivists on the left being called a beleftivist. But the topic of Binswanger's mailer was why immigration is a right, and I quote, every human action is a right unless it initiates physical force against another. So does the act of immigration initiate force? No, not per se. Does it threaten the initiation of force since the threat of force is force? No, not qua immigration. That is, some people walking or driving across the border do so in a way that threatens force, such as driving recklessly or coming in with weapons brandished. This has to be rare. Some come in planning or going to plan criminal acts. But it's not qua immigration that this happens. Sometimes natives of Newark, New Jersey, present an objective threat of force as they enter Manhattan, end quote. And I have to tell you, I just couldn't go on any further. It was a train wreck. Now bear in mind that Harry Binswanger has written many essays with which I would not hesitate to agree. But this one is really a train wreck in both the philosophical sense and certainly politically. So, does the act of immigration initiate force? Not if it's legal immigration, but if it's illegal immigration, not only is it not immigration per se, but it is an act of initiating force, because you're violating the jurisdiction of the government responsible for maintaining that jurisdiction. To compare immigrating from one country to another with natives of Newark, New Jersey going to Manhattan ignores the nature and identities of all the circumstances being presented. To illustrate by metaphor, a country is like a private home, and its borders are like the doors to one's home. When someone just walks into your country with the intentions of immigrating and living there without any due process, that's no different than the squatters that have recently been occupying the private homes of their owners without their consent. And as for someone moving from New Jersey to Manhattan, that's metaphorically like someone walking from the kitchen to the living room in the same house. The two circumstances are completely different from each other, and this view of open borders and an end to the nation-state is completely a left-wing ideology. To illustrate the pitfalls and perils of abandoning the nation-state, for the balance of this quarter of the show, we're going to time travel back to September 20th, 2006, when I appeared as the voice of the right on an episode of Left, Right, and Center, hosted by Jim Chapman against my opponent on the left, London lawyer Jeff Schlemmer.
Joining Junior and me in the studio now, Bob Metz and Jeff Schlemmer for our weekly Left, Right, and Center go around the table. And nice to see you both again.
Morning,
you,
Jim.
You know what I like about this studio as opposed to the old studio we used to work in? It actually is a round table. We actually are sitting at a round table.
Yeah.
And it sort of does have that sort of left, right, center, and wherever you want to be thing. I'd like to start today by asking you guys a question that we covered very, very briefly earlier today. And the bill apparently is now in on the evacuation of Canadians from Lebanon during the recent unpleasantness there. The government won't confirm it, but CTV says it's about $85 million. Lots of people at that time, lots of people now, and in the aftermath of this number are going to be complaining yet again about what is Canadian citizenship? What does it really mean? Should you be able to be a Canadian citizen, claim citizenship, and yet live in another country for long periods of time? What is the nature of citizenship? I made some comments, I think alluding back to the sort of the historical beginnings of this and the nation state, where your citizenship reflected entirely where you were born and raised and chose to live. You could change your citizenship by changing where you lived, but it was highly unusual for someone to be born, say, in Germany, move to England, become an Englander, and then to move somewhere else and claim that he was both English and German. It just you didn't do that sort of thing. You went to your new land and that's where you stayed. And if you went to another new land, you sort of assimilated there and you became that person. For the most part, not everyone, of course, and not people who were in transit, not merchants who were moving all the time, that sort of thing, but people who were settling down and building lives. You left one land behind, one way of life behind, and you adopted the one in the country you went to, and that's the way it is. And now we have the situation where we have lots of people with dual citizenship, where they're citizens of one country, then they decide, well, this country perhaps doesn't have the future I'd like for me and my family, so we're going to move to another country. Many of them move to Canada. We'll get citizenship there, too. Now we have dual citizenship. And, oh, by the way, things aren't so bad back in the home country anymore. I think I'll go back for 6 months or 8 months or a year or whatever and hang around, but I'm still a Canadian citizen, you know, and if there's any trouble, the government of Canada better spring to my assistance, and they better do it right smartly, or I'm going to be screaming to the CBC, which we saw happening a lot. Jeff, I'd like to ask you whether you have any personal thoughts on this issue of divided loyalties. Ultimately, to me, the purpose of citizenship, one of the purposes, is to define who you believe you are and to whom you are prepared to give your loyalties. Can we reasonably expect someone to give the same kinds of loyalty to two different countries?
Well, I would say yes, you can. And I think that the idea of the nation state is something that in the next couple of centuries will hopefully become less relevant than it is now. And that as technology advances and the world becomes smaller, so to speak, people travel more, their businesses are far more interconnected. I think that nations will hopefully become less relevant. And part of the reason I hope that is because so many wars have been based on national pride. I guess when you mention this issue, the overriding thing that occurs to me is that every country controls its definition of citizenship. And it's not imposed on it by anybody else. So in Canada, for instance, if we wanted to say, well, you can be a citizen, but if you've become a citizen from another country, we're not going to come and rescue you if that country goes sideways, for instance. It's perfectly open to us to do that. We also control things like taxation. If you're going to have earnings in another country, we may decide that we're going to take some tax for that, for example, as part of the price of maintaining citizenship. But I have noticed from time to time how with kind of trouble spots around the world, how there are people who have come back from Canada. Listening to a woman on the radio last week who is living in Baghdad now, had escaped as a refugee from Saddam Hussein's regime, lived in Canada for, 20 years or something, and is now back there kind of fighting for kind of women's rights, basically, in Baghdad, and I guess is kind of at great risk because a lot of the fundamentalist Muslims don't seem to be on the same page as far as women's rights. But again, somebody who's gone to Canada when things got too bad but has come back to try and help sort things out. I recall the president of one of the Baltic states, it was Latvia or Estonia, Lithuania, one of the three anyway, when the Berlin Wall came down and the USSR fell apart, the woman who became the president there was a Canadian citizen, somebody who had been born there but had lived all of her life in Canada and went back there. And I think that that's not a bad thing. And I've been struck over time by how one of the ways that Western society has sort of had influence was that for at least from the 1800s on, it became traditional for the children of the elite of whatever country, third world country it was, to go to Harvard, for instance, or go to Yale. We saw a ton of Japanese people do that in the late 1800s, for example. And so, they go to us, they kind of are exposed to our way of thinking about things, and hopefully we have some influence over them, and then they go back to where they came from, and hopefully...
They didn't come here and become American citizens.
Well, some do and some don't. But again, from my perspective, citizenship is a legal, arbitrary legal concept. And I understand what you're saying about loyalty to a place. Again, to me, that means loyalty to values of that country more so than the geographic part of it, for instance. So I understand what you're saying about that. But again, at root, maybe it's my lawyer mind thinking that, well, we can structure our definition of citizenship and we can decide who we allow to become citizens in a way that should benefit the country.
Is that the little one that's down there near the reptile brain?
I know.
Is that the same one?
With the same slimy kind of scaly skin.
Bob, what do you think?
Oh, I think I'm completely out of touch with both of you guys on this issue. Jim, on one side, you're talking about citizenship defines who you are. It's about divided loyalties. Jeff is saying that it's an arbitrary legal concept. Citizenship, for me, is all about the relationship of the citizen, an individual, to their government, specifically that government which protects their fundamental rights. I'm a citizen of Canada. I'm a resident of Ontario. I'm a resident of London. Canada is the government of my citizenship. Mm-hmm. Citizenship is also jurisdictional, based on land, property, which it has to be in order to be functional. This is something the Romans discovered when they put Rome together. That's why Rome became great. And to say that geography doesn't matter, as Jeff said, that was the exact thing that Rome solved. Everyone was defining themselves by nation states, by their race, by their religion. And Rome brought all that together under the rule of law, although some people thought that was terrible in the context of today's standards. Of course, they had great problems in Rome. Individual rights were not discovered yet, let's face it. But structure was discovered in the basic necessity of governments. But to speak to the bigger issue about dual citizenship, I think it's like you want to take your jurisdiction with you, portable jurisdiction. I'm a Canadian citizen, but I expect all my same rights and privileges to be honored no matter which country I go to. The country could, if it wished and had the resources, even act just on humanitarian grounds to do almost anything anywhere in the world if it wanted to. But I think in terms of its obligation, I think that's all within its jurisdiction. I don't think you stick your nose into other countries' businesses in that sense.
Is there any purpose then, except in some very specific cases where I mentioned, and you do see this Canada, the United States, and other countries too, where a child is born in that country and by virtue of the rules of that country is a citizen, but his parents are citizens of another country, so he is by virtue of the rules in most of those countries, he's a citizen there too. And for at least part of his life, he has that dual option. In some situations, it expires and others it does not, except for those accidents of birth.
Sure, and that's agreements between countries as well.
Is there any purpose ever to be, a useful purpose, do you think, to be served by serving, you know, two leaderships, really?
I can see what the perceived benefit of dual citizenship is, but I don't think dual citizenship is required to get that perceived benefit. I think all you need is agreements between countries. You don't have to be both, say, a British and Canadian citizen to have, say, lax or travel restrictions between the two. If they know you're one or the other, and as long as those countries have that condition, because believe me, even if they had dual citizenship and one of the countries became antagonistic to the other, I'll tell you that dual citizenship is going to fall apart real quick, just as quickly as an agreement would. Of travel and border issues that countries naturally have. But I think jurisdiction is extraordinarily important. I don't know that most people know, but until 1990 or so, you know, generally in Ontario, you did not have to be a citizen to vote either municipally or provincially. You had to be a taxpayer. The idea of that was, you know, taxation through representation, that it was the people being taxed who had a right to representation. But that was at local levels and provincial levels. Not citizenship is a slightly different thing because it deals with more, let us say, abstract issues. The issues of rights and freedoms and not just property issues and technicalities, roads and works and things like that.
Would we be any the worse off, do you think, either one of you, if we were to say, in the aftermath of what happened in Lebanon, the concern that people expressed about that with dual citizenship there, would we be any worse off if we were to decide, and Jeff, you made the point, and so did you, Bob, that these are decisions that we can make. If we said, Canadian citizenship is a valuable thing, and provided you can meet the criteria for that, we're happy to share it with you, but you have to make some decisions yourself. You're either a Canadian or you're not. You can't be a Canadian and a Ukrainian. You can't be a Canadian and Lebanese. You can't be a Canadian and a Chilean. You're either a Canadian or you're not. If we were to adopt a rule like that, would that help or hurt us, Jeff?
Well, I don't know that much about it. I'm sort of thinking in the back of my mind that I'm wondering whether that might be the case with the United States, because when I think about Canadian celebrities who have taken on American citizenship, it seems to they never seem to be dual citizens after that. And I'm thinking of who's the news anchor who died last year,
Peter Jennings.
Yeah, that him switching, Michael J. Fox, so those guys. That when they've switched, it seems to me they never say they're joint citizens. They say they're Americans now. So I'm not sure whether that might already be the rule there. As far as why they do that, I have no idea, except that in the back of my mind, I'm kind of thinking that it's not that easy to become a citizen to start with. In Canada, usually we kind of cherry pick the people who are just going to, somebody who shows up in Canada and says, I'd like to be a citizen. They better have skills that we need. They better have, there is an exception. If you've got a certain amount of money, we'll let you in. So the people that we're letting in, we, as a government, think are going to make Canada a better place. So it may be part of the horse trading we do to say, okay, well, we're glad to have you, glad to have your skills, glad to have your money. And if you want to stay a citizen of the other place, that's fine too, but we're going to tax you and all that stuff. So I guess there are probably some, there may be some thinking that the majority of dual citizens are people who are who are desirable people to have coming to our country and that we're willing to trade with them on something like that in order to get them. But I don't know that.
So it's okay to buy your citizenship, but not to buy your own health care?
Well, yeah, and I guess, though they pay it through their taxes, but it does strike me, though, when I mentioned earlier about how it's not a geographic thing, I was thinking about how, as Bob mentioned, when your mother country goes in another direction and suddenly you're a German-Canadian in World War I, for instance, it was striking how most of the immigrants seem, and this is a little bit different than dual citizenship, but there really didn't seem to be a big conflict of the mind or the heart for most of the people who had come over. They seemed to decide we're Canadians,
yeah,
we're
exactly
Americans.
Right. Yeah.
Japanese, for instance, I was just reading about the most highly decorated American unit in the Italian campaign in World War II were Japanese,
yes,
Americans. So it's interesting how geography actually does have a lot to do with it.
As if to shine a spotlight on the dilemma caused by so-called open immigration, on this side of our upcoming bumper, Redacted's Clayton Morris in conversation with Ralph Schollhammer on June 8th, prior to the European Parliament elections. And on the return side, the same two speakers as heard on June 11th, after the European elections.
Well, is Europe about to have a red wave, a conservative red wave, a series of elections taking place all across Europe? Will Europe move to the right? Is it already there? What are the implications of all of this? Let's ask academic researcher Ralph Schollhammer, who has his pulse on what is happening in politics all across Europe. And Ralph, welcome back to the show. Great to see you, my friend.
Great to be back. It's always an honor to be on with you.
So I want to talk about what's going on in Germany in just a second. We've seen blanket amnesty now for a lot of illegal immigrants, giving them citizenship. This could be the way to maybe hide the illegal immigration policy in Germany. We're seeing this in other countries as well. But you're seeing, I think, a real backlash right now to what's been happening in Europe over the past couple of years. And I think voters have just been fed up. What is happening to their countries? And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but we are starting to see a shift to the right. Here's the New York Times. You know it's bad because the New York Times has a front page story about this called Just How Dangerous Is Europe's Rising Far Right? So is Europe turning far right, Ralph?
Well, I mean, you would have to ask who isn't far right these days. It seems that everybody who is slightly to the right of the Greens is either far right, the extreme right, the radical right. I recently read an article in The Guardian and I was counting whether they ever just say the right. No, it's only the far right, the extreme right, the radical right. It's like in the United States, right? They're not the Republicans, they're only the extreme, ultra, mega Republicans. There is nothing else left. But as you correctly point out, this is a sign of panic. And let me give you, just when we talk about Germany also, a quick example that shows you how panicked they are. One of the major candidates of the Liberal Party has recently bragged on social media that she's suing 200 people every year for defamation. So you have a politician who does nothing but going through the internet day after day after day, looking if anybody makes a joke about her. And if so, right, they go to the courts. And what that tells you is the very insecurity that is now kind of spreading throughout the establishment. Because I have this theory, I need to flesh out in greater detail at some point, but I have this theory that kind of the first sign that a regime is crumbling is if they can no longer take a joke, right? And you see this now. We had these odd cases in France as well, but particularly in Germany, where politicians of the Green Party were suing comedians because they dared to mock Germany's foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, who is basically a satirical one-woman show all on her own. I mean, it's very hard not to make jokes of her, or to put it differently, every interview she gives is like a stand-up comedy thing. But again, these are elements of panic. And there's another element. If you would have asked me a week ago, is this conservative / European red wave gonna come? I probably would have said, I'm afraid that when it comes to the actual voting, too many Europeans are going to say again, can I really give my vote to those, you know, right-wing radicals, which they are not, but this is how they are presented, right? And many people consume media on a day-to-day basis. They are not like you and I who are kind of permanently in the weeds and into the intrinsic details of this. It's people who work all day and then they read the newspaper. So, of course, they're influenced by this. We must kind of free ourselves from the idea that totalitarianism is only Hitler and Stalin, right? That the tyranny, if it's not jackboots smashing in your door at 4 a.m. in the morning, although if you look at the United States with the FBI, that does on occasion happen, but it's also kind of small, more capricious acts of tyranny. Like when they say, of course you can say whatever you want, but, you know, this is going to happen. Or, you know, we're gonna tell your employer. Like, I'm sure that some of your viewers and listeners have heard about the story about these rich kids on the German vacation spot who were singing, admittedly, you know, a somewhat raucous and maybe not very polite song about foreigners. Again, not something that I would do. But like immediately their names, their addresses, their employers, like all of this was made public. So even something that, again, is stupid, no question, but immediately it goes to, we have to destroy these people's careers. And at the same time, just to make this last point, so you had this kind of 20-something year olds who sang a stupid song, right? They literally lost their jobs. One girl is very, very close to be kicked out of university, all these kind of things. So they showed their pictures, everything. But the guy who was stabbing people in Germany a couple of days ago, right? They pixeled his face. They didn't mention his name. So this shows that the establishment, and by the way, you see the same in the United Kingdom as well, where it's gonna, there is a double standard in policing. Being right of center puts you at much greater risk to catch the eye of the state than being left of center or being an Islamist. That is simply a fact, because that's such an insane thing. So Germany told us, that Europeans told its citizens, that after 2015, don't worry, all these people that come to us, they will leave again. Like once the war is over, once the situation is safe again in their home countries, they're going to go. But as you pointed out, there have been 200,000 citizenships have been granted in Germany last year. 80,000 went to people from Syria, Right? How? Why? Right? It's the exact opposite. They were told, right, or the Germans were told, these people will leave. Now they make them into German citizens. And the really insidious thing is, of course, if one of those people now commits a crime, the newspapers will say, German man committed a crime. Of course, right, they just get prison. And it gets, let me, one last point, because it's so insane. At the there's like similar to the United States, there's kind of a little celebration when people get their citizenship, right? And in one case, one guy got the German passport from a female civil servant, from a female German public servant. And he refused to shake her hand because she's an infidel woman. But that is no longer grounds not to give people citizenship. So we're literally handing out citizenship to Islamists and think nothing about it.
I mean,
it's mad.
It is insane. It is insane. And so, and this is why they wanted to keep it quiet. This is why Germany wanted to keep this quiet, that they're just blanketly giving out citizenship to individuals. They don't want you to know about it. And this is how they get away with it. So when someone commits an act of violence, someone commits murder, they can say, yes, oh, that's a German citizen. Well, it looks like Europe has given the big middle finger to globalism. If this just happened in one country, it might be, you know, sort of a one-off. If it happened in two countries, maybe you could say this is a coincidence, but the red wave of elections appears to have hit Europe. And we wanted to bring back in academic researcher Ralph Schulhammer, who we talked about this just a few days ago before the elections. Were we going to see a massive red wave come to Europe? And Ralph is back with us today. Ralph, it looks like that has happened. Let me just go down the list here, because again, I think if this was just like a one or two countries, we could say, maybe a coincidence. You have France trouncing Emmanuel Macron's party in France. We just got word, breaking news just a few minutes ago, Emmanuel Macron saying he is not going to resign. Belgium, huge wins there. You have Italy, Germany, Ireland, Austria, Spain, Netherlands. I mean, the list is pretty extensive. And you have Poland. I just got word a few minutes ago from sources in Poland. Unbelievable results there on the conservative side as well. So I think I think it's safe to say a red wave has struck Europe. No?
I think you're right. I mean, I know we have to say this now because in the comments, people immediately say, in Europe, you don't call it a red wave. It's a blue wave because conservatives over here, I call it blue.
But
call it. I just tried to preemptively, you know, save people the effort then to once again correct the two of us in the comments. I personally, I hate to admit this, I was hoping for more of a wave than it ultimately became. I always say it was a shift, but it was not an earthquake as I was hoping for. For example, the Freedom Party, which is kind of the Austrian version of the Alternative for Germany, or Austria's Le Pen, if you want, they were predicted to get between 27 and 30% of the vote. They ended up with 25% or 25.5%. And I found that a little bit disappointing. I think the AfD in Germany could have done better if they would not have almost self-destruct shortly before the election, which shows you, which is also, I think, equally important, that right-wing parties in Europe have, let's call it, different degrees of maturity. Le Pen, for example, and sometimes she gets criticized by this for non-French right-wingers, let's say, that she has also signed up to the globalist agenda, as did Meloni. And so I cut them some slack, because I think what they're doing, and maybe I'm wrong and too optimistic, but I think they are trying to play the long game. It is often forgotten that France and Italy even more so, these are notoriously difficult countries to govern. And I think what Meloni is trying to do is, she says, in order to change things in a sustainable way, I need to stay in power. I mean, look at what the EU is talking about. Their plan, if von der Leyen cannot be maintained in office, is to replace her with Mario Draghi. I mean, this is like a zombie movie. Like, you know, at the end of the movie, they bury the monster. And then when the camera, you know, moves out, you see once again the hand coming out of the grave and saying, it's not over. And this is exactly like this. So the establishment, if the bureaucracy, they will try to strike back. And yes, there's a lot of things that I would have hoped Meloni would do that she didn't do. But I'm still happy if Meloni is in charge and not Draghi or Baerbock or, you know, or you name it. So I think we have to learn on the right that sustainable victories and a kind of a series of victories
is more important than one-offs that make us feel good, but then start to fizzle out. I mean, this is basically what Trump said, and he was correct about this, about the deep state. It's not enough to sometimes be the president. It's not enough to be sometimes in office. You need to create conditions where even if you lose office, your ideas, your vision of the future is still in power. And that's the last point. And that's the crucial thing about the Greens. Like, the Greens have been decimated, but they have not infiltrated, they have marinated, they have socialized an entire generation of students, of public servants, of institutions, that even if they would be gone from parliaments tomorrow, their ideas would still last, right? This is something, it's like an, I don't know, like a cold, if you want, that gradually we have to get, you know, we have to cure ourselves gradually off. And just winning the occasional election is not enough. We need to play the long game here.
After hearing about those objections to the use of the term red wave to describe a political move to the right in Europe, since, of course, conservatism and the right are usually associated with the color blue, I couldn't help but be reminded of my raising this very point back on March 11th, 2010, when none other than Ann Coulter was our guest on this show. And just wait till you hear how, why, and when the American Republicans were painted with the color red. Robert Vaughn and I were co-hosting that live broadcast on CHRW FM radio in London, and here's how that part went.
What brings you to Canada? Have you been to Canada before?
Not professionally, but yes, I've been to Canada before, not for years. I haven't really been much of any place for years. I've been working.
Hey, listen, you know, I have to give you a real warning. When you do come to Canada, I don't know if anyone's warned you about this, but up here, the color blue means conservative, and the color red is liberal.
Well, thank you. That makes a lot more sense. You know, our division breaks down from the 2000 election when Gore refused to concede and the counting went on and on and on. And the network chose it. And, I mean, everyone sort of recognized at the time, though this has been lost to history, that the reason they made the right-wingers red was that they just thought it was a little too spot-on with the Democrats, getting a little close to calling them commies. So they reversed what your normal thinking would be.
I was so curious about that because I was wondering, like, doesn't everybody call, you know, the commies reds, right? The reds, right? And I was wondering why would the so-called Republicans or conservatives possibly put up with that label there? And it certainly confuses we Canadians when we're watching your elections down there.
Well, it confused all of us. We tried resisting for a while, but it's one of those things you can't fight the machine.
Now, just a question for you. Is there a distinction between right-wing, the terms right-wing, Republican, and conservative? Are they all the same thing to you? Is there any distinction in those terms to you?
There's a lot of overlap. But there's a difference between conservative and Republican because there are some Republicans who aren't conservative. There aren't too many conservatives who aren't Republicans, though. There used to be a lot more. This is probably very boring to Canadians, but many years ago there were the famed, you know, Southern Democrats who were very patriotic and right-wing. Basically, with Reagan's election, it was the end of that. Same thing with blue-collar voters, union guys. You had a lot of them voting Democrat, but, you know, their number one issue was not that global warming and that beachfront property might erode. It was not abortion on demand or promoting girl firemen. So, you know, they'd always, their parents were Democrats, their grandparents were Democrats, they always voted Democrat, but they were conservatives. There's a lot less of that now as the union guys and the Southern Democrats have now joined the Democratic Party, and probably a lot of the Northeast liberals who used to have the Rockefeller Republicans, John Lindsay in New York. Basically, the Northeast, the New York area, is very liberal. So people who call themselves Republicans were indistinguishable from Democrats, and sometimes even worse.
We have the same problem up here, really, in the sense of our liberals and conservatives in terms of policy are quite indistinguishable from each other.
Well, they're both socialists, Bob.
I agree.
From our perspective,
certainly.
That is very frustrating.
Frustrating. Yeah, that's one word for it. If red is the color of liberal socialism and blue is the color of conservative socialism, then what are the colors of tyranny and freedom? And that's a black and white question if ever there was one, because some things are black and white, even in politics. I'll leave it to you to decide which best matches which political polarity. I'm guessing you'll have the right answer to that question long before you join us again next week, when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
So the Jew, a Hindu, and a politician went hiking. They were searching for a hotel or motel. In desperation, they knock on the door of the home of a farmer. They say, "We just need a place to stay the night." He says, "Sure, problem is I only have two beds in my home, so one of you three will have to sleep in the barn." The Hindu goes to the barn. 10 minutes later, there's a knock on their bedroom. The Hindu is by the room. He says, "There's no way I can sleep in the barn." He says, "I'm a Hindu. There's a cow in the barn. How can a Hindu sleep with a holy cow?" "Okay," the Jew says, "I guess I'll have to sleep in the barn." The Jew goes to the barn. 10 minutes later, there's a knock on the door. The Jew is back. They say, "What's the problem?" The Jew says, "No way that I'm going to sleep in the barn." "Why not?" Jew says, "There's a pig in the barn. How do you expect a Jew to sleep with a pig?" Politician says, "I guess I'll have to go to the barn." So the Jew and the Hindu go to bed, and the politician goes to the barn. 10 minutes later, there's a knock on the door. The Jew and the Hindu open the door, and they see the pig and the cow.